Final reflections. Following our comments on Macbeth's experience of nature and on the quality of his recognition or insight into his actions and their consequences, these remarks are supplemental to the commentary already offered for Acts 1 through 5. Reflections on Macbeth's experience of nature as weird or uncanny. Still pertaining to Act 5, Scene 5, as well as to other sections of Macbeth, nature, as represented by Birnam Wood, must seem strange or uncanny to Macbeth, because he himself has become unnatural, even monstrous. This apparent strangeness, dare we say weirdness, in nature punishes him. He has betrayed his natural lord, Duncan, his father in Jacobean political theory, and turned his marriage bond into a criminal partnership. See Stephen Greenblatt's insightful commentary on nature and the demonic in Macbeth in his introductory remarks to that play. What follows is my own interpretation of Macbeth's experience of nature. The meaning of the term weird, as applied to the three sisters, itself requires some attention. Critics have pointed out that in Shakespeare's day, the adjective weird did not have the connotation of uncanny, frightening, bizarre, etc. Instead, it more closely matched the Old English root word weird, W-Y-R-D, which referred to fate or destiny. At the same time, it's also often said that it is Shakespeare's portrayal of the sisters, along with his application to them of the adjective weird, that fueled the transition to the newer meaning. This effect may, of course, be partly due to later audiences' responses to Shakespeare's representation of the sisters and his linguistic choice of weird to describe them. But it's fair to suggest that there is, within Shakespeare's own usage, something of the newer connotation of the term. Something in the portrayal of the sisters, that is, may have sparked the newer connotation in readers and audiences, aside from any newfangled influences due to their own time and culture. The current meaning is not simply an artifact of the play's interpretation in ages long subsequent. It makes sense to this commentator to enlist that term, weird, as a useful and revealing way of talking about Macbeth's experience of the natural world. For all his genuine and deep love of nature, Shakespeare is working within a Christian framework where sin has deranged the entire creation, just as it will later in Milton's Paradise Lost, Book 9. Eve, quote-unquote, plucked, she ate, earth felt the wound, and nature from her seat, sighing through all her works, gave signs of woe that all was lost. Nature responds as if by sympathetic magic to human error, reflecting that error back to us, if we knew how to interpret nature's signs. Sinful humanity within this tradition is self-alienated from the natural world. In such a context, the sense of strangeness or weirdness that Macbeth experiences at key parts of the play may fairly be construed as a function of providence, which makes use of whatever is at hand to punish transgressors. The very darkness of the night, as in the escape of Fleance in Act 3, Scene 3, and the branches of trees from Birnam Wood, here in Act 5, will serve its turn. In his Norton Shakespeare Tragedies introduction to Macbeth, Stephen Greenblatt wisely notes the strangeness and equivocal quality of the play's supernatural realm. Greenblatt suggests that the secular and the demonic, the material and the spiritual, are difficult to keep separate. The witch's equivocation is a power stalking human desire and endeavor, an opening into the demonic, leading us to the everlasting bonfire. No doubt it receives a strong assist from the inherent ambiguity of language itself. Further reflections. What is the quality of Macbeth's recognition? Moreover, is the play as a whole nihilistic? Do Macbeth's concluding thoughts and resolutions constitute a classical recognition, or an anagnorisis, to use Aristotle's term, That's spelled A-N-A-G-N-O-R-I-S-I-S. In his notes on Macbeth, Samuel Taylor Coleridge describes the play as follows. There is, quote unquote, there is an entire absence of comedy, nay, even of irony and philosophic contemplation in Macbeth, the play being wholly and purely tragic. The play is purely tragic as opposed to reflective, as Hamlet would surely be called. But there is no lack of introspection or understanding on the part of Macbeth. His tragedy involves the process of desiring honors and attaining them by unjust means, of buying into the epistemological and moral ambiguity proffered by the weird sisters, and then being driven by events to exchange his certitude for profound weariness and disillusionment. What does Macbeth learn by the play's end? He comes to understand what he has done and why it was wrong, but he also recognizes that it doesn't matter to him anymore. His life has become meaningless. The language accorded to the isolated, brittle king is some of the finest Shakespeare ever gave to any character. Its mixture of aesthetic beauty and desolation of spirit shows an intellect undebased, but constrained now to describing and coming to terms with a situation that would horrify anyone with normal sensibilities. Macbeth's fine words are insightful, but hollow, as if he himself can't feel them and finds no comfort in them. They are empty words, not a curative, and certainly no better than the quote-unquote physic he had earlier cast to the dogs. Shakespeare takes great interest in how his key characters handle the relationship between actions and words. Macbeth's words, we can tell, provide him with insight, but they offer no relief. Shakespeare's plays have various ways of dealing with the consequences of tragic mistakes. King Lear gains insight at the expense of being able to wield power. By the end of the play, he and his daughter Cordelia are at the mercy of their enemies. Macbeth follows a different pattern. Once he makes his choice, he must take on the ruthlessness of the tyrant who holds his throne by injustice. Blood draws on blood until, as Macbeth says, there's no point in going back. He acts boldly and dies fighting, but such desperation hardly makes him a hero. Instead, he's the puppet of actions that stem from his own perverted will. The witches shoot an arrow into Macbeth's soul, but they are not ultimately responsible for his crimes. Ambition is a lucid madness. Images present themselves to Macbeth. Truth comes as presentiment. But his own ambition drives him to inhabit the vision. The consequences of his behavior are predictable, if strange. We should not be too surprised by Macbeth's sin. Shakespeare's genius is to take what might have been a stage villain and make him a three-dimensional character, but one who is nonetheless a stunning failure as a human being. As for the play's politics, it's hard to see how some critics' claims that Macbeth, first performed in 1606, is tinged with nihilism can be correct. Given that the play was written for King James I, with the infamous 1605 gunpowder plot in his immediate past. The more tenable view of Macbeth's moral arc is that sin punishes itself inexorably, even if the interval between commission and punishment is long. Anarchy shadows this play, but only in the sense that Macbeth makes a bad but free choice, and from then on, his choice generates chaos for others who live in his realm. Macbeth marches to his death, behaves like a beast, losing his title to humanity, and dies fighting. The Christian point is that free will, misused, becomes the slave of so-called fate or necessity. This is a point made by Augustine in his Enchiridion, spelled Enchiridion, and other works. Oscar Wilde said that when we act, we become puppets. Shakespeare might add, yes, but only when we act badly. Apparent disorder does not imply disorder in the heavens, or chaos in the fundamental nature of things, the quote-unquote great chain of being. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Saturday, July 26, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations from Macbeth, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.